Part 3 Chapter 11 Prince Hohenlohe listened to Lawrence's attempted explanations without very much expression. Some 60 years of age, with a jovial face rendered dignified rather than unpleasantly formal by his white powdered wig, he looked nonetheless determined.
"Little enough did Britain offer to the defeat of the tyrant you so profess to hate," he said finally, when Lawrence had done. "No army has come across from your shores to join the battle. Others, Captain, might have complained that the British prefer to spend gold than blood. But Prussia is not unwilling to bear the brunt of war. Yet 20 dragons we were assured and promised and guaranteed, and now we stand on the eve of war and none are here. Does Britain mean to dishonour her agreement?"
"Sir, not a thought of it, I swear to you,"
Thorndyke said, glaring daggers at Lawrence.
"There can be no such intention," Lawrence said. "What has delayed them, sir, I cannot guess, but that can only increase my anxiety to be home. We are a little more than a week's flying away. If you will give me safe passage, I can be gone and back before the end of the month, and I trust with the full company which you have been promised."
"We may not have so long, and I am not inclined to accept more hollow assurances," Hohenlohe said. "If the promised company appears, you may have your safe passage. Until then you will be our guest, or, if you like, you may do what you can to fulfil the promises which were made. That I leave to your conscience."
He nodded to his guard, who opened the tent door, signifying plainly the interview was at an end, and despite the courtliness of his manners there was iron underlying his words.
"I hope you are not so damned foolish you will sit about watching and give them still more disgust of us,"
Thorndyke said when they had left the tent. Lawrence wheeled on him very angry.
"As I might have hoped that you would have taken our part, rather than encourage the Prussians in treating us more as prisoners than allies and insulting the corps. A pretty performance from a British officer when you know damned well our circumstances."
"What a couple of eggs can matter next to this campaign you have leave to try and convince me," Thorndyke said. "For God's sake, do you not understand what this could mean? If Bonaparte rolls them up, where the devil do you suppose he will look next but across the Channel? If we do not stop him here, we will be stopping him in London this time next year, or trying to, and half the country in flames. You aviators would rather do anything than risk these beasts you are hooked to. I know that well enough, but surely you can see—"
"That is enough. That is damned well enough," Lawrence said. "My God, you go too far."
He gave the man his back and stalked away in a simmering rage. He was not, by nature, a quarrelsome man, and he had rarely so wanted satisfaction. To have his courage questioned, and his commitment to duty, and withal an insult to his service, was very hard to bear, and he thought if their circumstances had been anything other than desperate, he could not have restrained himself. But the prohibition forbidding corps officers to duel was not an ordinary regulation, to be circumvented. Here, of all places, in the middle of a war, he could not risk some injury, even short of death, that might not only leave him out of the battle, but would cast Temeraire wholly down. But he felt the stain to his honour deeply.
"And I suppose that damned hussar is off thinking to himself, 'I have not the courage of a dog,'" he said bitterly.
"You did just as you ought, thank heaven," Granby said, pale with relief. "There's no denying it's a wrench, but the risk isn't to be borne. You needn't see the fellow again. Ferris and I can go between with him, if there's anything we must deal with him for."
"I thank you, but I should sooner let him shoot me than let him think I have the least reluctance to face him," Lawrence said.
Granby had met him at the entrance to the covert. Now together they reached the small, bare clearing which had been assigned them. Temeraire was curled up in what comfort he could find, and listening intently to the conversation of the Prussian dragons near him, ears and ruff pricked up with attention, while the men busied themselves at cooking fires, snatching a hasty meal.
"Are we leaving now?" he asked, when Lawrence arrived.
"No, I am afraid not," Lawrence said, calling over his other senior officers, Ferris and Riggs, to join them. "Well, gentlemen, we are in the thick of it," he told them grimly. "They have refused us the safe conduct."
When Lawrence had finished giving them the whole of the situation, Ferris burst out,
"But, sir, we will fight, won't—"
I mean, will we fight with them?" hastily correcting himself.
"We are not children or cowards to sulk in a corner when there is a battle to hand, and of such vital importance," Lawrence said. "Offensive they have been. But I will grant they have been sorely tried, and they might be as outrageous as they liked before I would let pride keep us from doing our duty. And there can scarcely be any question of that, only I wish to God I knew why the corps had not sent the promised aid."
"There's only one thing it can be. There must be needed more somewhere else," Granby said. "And likely enough it's the same reason they sent us, for the eggs in the first place. Only if the Channel is not under bombardment, the trouble must be somewhere overseas, some great upset in India, or trouble in Halifax."
"Oh, maybe we are taking back the American colonies,"
Ferris offered. Riggs opined that it was more likely the colonials had invaded Nova Scotia, ungrateful, rebellious sods. And they wrangled it back and forth a moment before Granby interrupted their fruitless speculation.
"Well, it don't matter where, exactly. The Admiralty will never strip the Channel bare, no matter how busy Bonaparte is elsewhere. And if all the spare dragons are coming home by transport, any sort of mess at sea could have held them up. But if they are already 2 months overdue, surely they must arrive any moment."
"For my part, Captain, I hope you'll forgive my saying. I'd as soon stay and fight if they get here tomorrow,"
Riggs said in his bluff, forthright way.
"We could always pass the eggs to some middleweight to take home. It would be a damned shame to miss a chance to help give Boney a drubbing."
"Of course we must stay and fight," Temeraire put in,
dismissing the entire question with a flick of his tail. And indeed there would have been no restraining him if the battle were anywhere in his vicinity. Young male dragons were not notably reluctant to jump into an affray.
"It is a great pity that Maximus and Lily are not here, and the rest of our friends, but I am very glad at last we will get to fight the French again. I am sure we can beat them this time too, and then maybe," he added suddenly, sitting up. His eyes widened, and his ruff mounted up with a visible rush of enthusiasm. "The war will be over, and we can go home and see to the liberty of dragons after all."
Lawrence was startled by the intensity of his own sensation of relief. Though uneasy, he had not properly realized how very low Temeraire had sunk, that this burst of excitement should provide so sharply defined a contrast. It wholly overcame any inclination he might have had to voice discouraging cautions. Though a victory here, he was well aware, was necessary but not sufficient to Bonaparte's final defeat. It was entirely possible, he privately argued with his conscience, that Bonaparte might be forced to make terms, if thoroughly checked in this campaign, and thus give Britain real peace for at least a little while. So he merely said,
"I am glad that you are all of like mind with me, gentlemen, so far as engaging to fight. But we must now consider our other charge. We have bought these eggs too dear in blood and gold to lose them now. We cannot assume the corps will arrive in time to take them safely home, and if this campaign lasts us more than a month or two, as is entirely likely, we will have the Kazilik egg hatching in the midst of a battlefield."
Then none of them spoke for a moment. Granby, with his fair skin flushed up, red to his roots, and then went pale. He dropped his eyes and said nothing.
"We have them properly bundled up, sir, in a tent with a good brazier and a couple of the ensigns watching it every minute," Ferris said, after a moment glancing at Granby. "Keynes says they will do nicely, and if it comes to real fighting we'd best set the ground crew down somewhere well behind the lines and leave Keynes behind to look after the eggs. If we have to fall back, we could stop and catch them all up quick enough."
"If you are worried," Temeraire put in unexpectedly, "I will ask it to wait as long as it can, once the shell is a little harder and it can understand me."
They all looked blankly at him.
"Ask it to wait?" Lawrence said, confused. "Do you mean the hatchling? Surely it is not a matter of choice."
"Well, one does begin to be very hungry, but it does not feel so pressing until one is out of the shell," Temeraire said, as if this were a matter of common knowledge. "And everything outside seems very interesting once one understands what is being said, but I am sure the hatchling can wait a little while."
"Lord, the Admiralty will stare,"
Riggs said, after they had all chewed over this startling piece of intelligence. "Though perhaps it is only celestials who are like that. I'm sure I never heard a dragon talk of remembering anything from inside the shell at all."
"Well, there is nothing to talk about," Temeraire said prosaically. "It is quite uninteresting. That is why one comes out."
Lawrence dismissed them to go and begin to make some sort of camp with their limited supplies. Granby hurried away with only a nod. The other lieutenants exchanged a look and followed him. Lawrence supposed it was less common with aviators than with navy men that a man got his step only for being in the right place at the right moment, hatchings being under more regular control than captured ships. In the early days of their acquaintance, Granby had himself been one of those officers resentful of Lawrence's acquiring temeraire. Lawrence understood his constraint and his reluctance to speak. Granby could neither speak in favour of a course which would almost certainly result in his being the most senior candidate available when the egg should hatch, nor protest against one which would require him to make the attempt to harness a hatchling under the most dire circumstances, in the midst of a battlefield, the egg barely in their hands for a few weeks, of a rare breed almost unknown to them, and almost certainly no future chance of promotion if he failed. Lawrence spent the evening writing letters in his small tent. All he had in the way of quarters, and that having been put up by his own crew, there had been no offer made to quarter him or his men more formally, though there were barracks for the Prussian aviators erected all around the covert. In the morning he meant to go into Dresden and see if he could arrange to draw funds on his bank. The last of his money would be gone in a day, provisioning his men and temeraire at wartime prices, and he had no inclination to go begging to the Prussians under the present circumstances. A little while after dark, Thake tapped one of the tent poles and came in. The ugly wound at least had not mortified, but he was still limping a little, and would bear the deep gouge upon his thigh the rest of his days, a furrow of flesh all seared away. Lawrence got up and waved him to the cushion-heaped box, which was all he had as a chair. "Now sit. I will do perfectly well here," he said, and himself lay down Turkish-style upon the other cushions on the ground. "I have only come for a moment," Thake said. "Lieutenant Granby tells me we are not to leave. I understand Temeraire has been taken in lieu of 20 dragons."
"Flattering, I suppose, if considered that way," Lawrence said wryly. "Yes, we are established here, if against our design, and whether we can fill that tally or no, we mean to do what we can."
Thake nodded.
"Then I will keep my word to you," he said, "and tell you this time that I mean to depart. I doubt an untrained man would be anything other than a dangerous nuisance aboard Temeraire's back in an aerial battle, and you hardly need a guide when you cannot stir out of the camp. I cannot be of any further use to you."
"No," Lawrence said slowly, reluctant but unable to argue the point. "And I will not press you to stay in our present circumstances, though I am sorry to lose you against a future need, and I cannot at the moment reward you as your pains have deserved."
"Let us defer it," Thake said. "Who knows? We may meet again. The world is not, after all, so very large a place."
He spoke with that faint smile and stood to give Lawrence his hand.
"I hope we shall," Lawrence said, gripping it,
"and that I may be of use to you in turn some day."
Thake refused an offer to try and get him a more personal safe conduct, and indeed Lawrence did not have much fear he would need one despite his game leg. With no further ado, Thake put up the hood of his cloak and, picking up his small bundle, was gone into the bustle and noise of the covert. There were few guards posted around the dragons, and he vanished quickly among the scattered campfires and bivouacs. Lawrence had sent Colonel Thorndyke a stiff, short word that they meant to offer their services to the Prussians. In the morning the colonel came again to the covert, bringing with him a Prussian officer, rather younger than other of the senior commanders, with a truly impressive moustache, whose tips hung below his chin, and a fierce hawk-like expression.
"Your Highness, may I present Captain William Lawrence of His Majesty's Aerial Corps," Thorndyke said. "Captain, this is Prince Louis Ferdinand, commander of the advance guard. You have been assigned to his command."
They were forced, for direct communication, to resort to French. Lawrence ruefully thought that at least his mastery of that language was improving, with as much use as he was being forced to make of it. Indeed, he was, for once, not the worse speaker, as Prince Louis spoke with a thick and almost impenetrable accent.
"Let us see his range, his skill," Prince Louis said, gesturing to Temeraire.
He called over a Prussian officer, Captain Dyhern, from one of the neighbouring coverts, and gave him instructions to lead his own heavyweight, Eroica, and their formation in a drill to give them the example. Lawrence stood by Temeraire's head watching, with private dismay. He had wholly neglected formation drill practice over the long months since their departure from England, and even at the height of their form they could not have matched the skill on display. Eroica was nearly the size of Maximus, Temeraire's year-mate, and a regal copper, the very largest breed of dragon known, and he was not a fast flyer, but when he moved in square, his corners nearly had points, and the distance separating him from the other dragons scarcely varied to the naked eye.
"I do not at all understand. Why are they flying that way?"
Temeraire said, head cocked to one side.
"Those turns look very awkward, and when they reversed there was enough room for anyone to go between them."
"It is only a drill, not a battle formation," Lawrence said. "But you can be sure they will do all the better in combat for the discipline and the precision required to perform such manoeuvres."
Temeraire snorted.
"It seems to me that they would do better to practice things that would actually be of use. But I see the pattern. I can do it now," he added.
"Are you sure you would not like to observe a little longer?"
Lawrence asked anxiously. The Prussian dragons had only gone through one full repetition, and he, for his own part, would not at all have minded a little time to practice the manoeuvre in privacy.
"No, it is very silly, but it is not at all difficult," Temeraire said.
This was perhaps not the best spirit in which to enter into the practice, and Temeraire had never much liked formation flying at all, even the less rigorous British style. For all Lawrence could do to restrain him, he dashed through the manoeuvre at high speed, a good deal quicker than the Prussian formation had managed it, not to mention than any other dragon over a lightweight in size could have kept up with, spiralling himself about in a flourishy way to boot.
"I put in the turning over so that I would always be looking out of the formation body,"
Temeraire added, coiling himself down to the ground, rather pleased with himself.
"That way I could not be surprised by an attack."
This cleverness plainly did not much impress Prince Louis, nor Eroica, who gave a short, coughing snort as dismissive as a sniff. Temeraire pricked up his ruff at it and sat up on his haunches, narrow-eyed.
"Sir," Lawrence said hurriedly, to forestall any quarrelling, "perhaps you are not aware that Temeraire is a celestial. They have a particular skill—"
Here he stopped, abruptly aware that divine wind might sound poetical and exaggerated if directly translated.
"Demonstrate, if you please,"
Prince Louis said, gesturing. There was no appropriate target nearby, however, but a small stand of trees. Temeraire obligingly smashed them down with one deep-chested, violent roar, by no means the full range of his strength, in the process rousing the whole covert of dragons into loud calls and inquiries and sparking a terrified, distant whinnying from the cavalry on the opposite side of the encampment. Prince Louis inspected the shattered trunks with some interest.
"Well, when we have pushed them back onto their own fortifications, that will be useful," he said. "At what distance is it effective?"
"Against seasoned wood, sir, not very great," Lawrence said. "He would have to come too near exposed to their guns. However, against troops or cavalry the range is greater, and I am sure would have excellent effect."
"Ah, but too dear a cost,"
Prince Louis said, waving a hand expressively towards the perfectly audible sound of the shrilling horses.
"The army which exchanges its cavalry for dragon corps will be defeated in the field if their opponent's infantry hold. This the work of Frederick the Great conclusively has proven. Have you before fought in a ground engagement?"
"No, sir,"
Lawrence was forced to admit. Temeraire had only a few actions at all to his credit, all purely aerial engagements, and despite many years' service Lawrence could not claim any experience himself, for while most aviators come up through the ranks would have had some practice at least working in support of infantry, he had spent those years afloat, and by whatever chance had never been at a land battle of any kind. Prince Louis shook his head and straightened up.
"We will not try and train you up now," he said. "Better to make of you the best use we can. You will sweep with Eroica's formation in early battle, then hold the enemy off their flanks. Keep with them, and you will not spook the cavalry."
Having inquired into Temeraire's complement, Prince Louis insisted also on providing them with a few Prussian officers and another half a dozen ground hands to fill out their numbers. Lawrence could not deny the extra hands were of use, after the unhappy losses which he had suffered without replacement since their departure from England. Digby and Balesworth only lately, MacDonagh killed in the desert, and poor little Morgan slain along with half his harness-men in the French night assault near Madeira so long ago, when they had scarcely weighed anchor. The new men seemed to know their work, but they spoke almost no English, and very indifferent French, and he could not like having such perfect strangers aboard, he was anxious a little for the eggs. The Prussians were plainly not much appeased by his willingness to assist. They had softened a little towards Temeraire and his crew, but the aerial corps were still being spoken of as treacherous. Aside from the pain which this could not help but give Lawrence, as this justification had been sufficient to make the Prussians comfortable in keeping him against his will, he would not have been wholly astonished if they took the opportunity to commandeer the Kazilik egg, should they become aware of the imminent hatching. He had made mention of his urgency without telling them precisely that the egg was so near its time, and he had not said it was a Kazilik, which should certainly provide a great increase of temptation. The Prussians did not have a fire breather either, but with the Prussian officers about, the secret was in some jeopardy, and they were all unknowing, teaching the eggs German by their conversation, which should make a seizure all the easier. He had not discussed the matter with his own officers, but that had not been necessary to make them share his concerns. Granby was a popular first officer, well-liked, and even if he had been roundly loathed, none of the crew could have been happy to see the fruit of all their desperate labours snatched away. Without any instructions, they were standoffish to the Prussian officers and cautious to keep them away from the eggs, which were left in their swaddling clothes and kept at the heart of their camp under a now tripled volunteer guard posted by Ferris whenever Temeraire was engaged in manoeuvres or exercise. This did not occur very often. The Prussians did not believe in exerting dragons very much outside of battle. The formations daily drilled, and went on reconnaissance missions, probing out a little way into the countryside, but they did not go very far, being constrained by the range of their slowest members. Lawrence's suggestion that he should take Temeraire farther afield had been denied, on the grounds that if they were to encounter any French party they should be taken, or lead them back towards the Prussian encampment, providing too much intelligence in exchange for small gain. Yet another of Frederick the Great's maxims, which he was growing tired of hearing. Only Temeraire was perfectly happy. He was rapidly acquiring German from the Prussian crewmen, and he was just as pleased not to have to be constantly performing formation exercises.
"I do not need to fly around in squares to do well in a battle," he said. "It is a pity not to see more of the countryside, but it does not matter. Once we have beaten Napoleon, we can always come back for a visit."
He regarded the coming battle in the light of an assured victory, as indeed did nearly the whole of the army around them, except for the grumbling Saxons, mostly reluctant conscripts. There was much to give foundation to such hopes. The level of discipline throughout the camp was wonderful to behold, and the infantry drill beyond anything Lawrence had ever seen. If Hohenlohe was not a genius of Napoleon's calibre, he certainly seemed a soldierly kind of general, and his swelling army, large as it was, comprised less than half of the Prussian forces, and that not even counting the Russians, who were massing in the Polish territories to the east and would soon march in support. The French would be badly outnumbered, operating far from their home territory with supply lines stretched thin. They would not be able to bring many dragons with them, and the lingering threat of Austria on their flank and Britain across the Channel would force Napoleon to leave a good portion of his troops behind, to guard against a surprise late entry into the war on the part of either power.
"Who has he fought, anyway? The Austrians and the Italians and some heathens in Egypt?" Captain Dyhern said.
Lawrence had, out of courtesy, been admitted to the captain's mess of the Prussian aviators, and they were happy on the occasion of his visits to shift their conversation to French, for the pleasure of describing to him the inevitable defeat of that nation.
"The French have no real fighting quality, no morale. A few good beatings, and we will see his whole army melt away."
The other officers all nodded and seconded him, and Lawrence was as willing as any of them to raise a glass to Bonaparte's defeat, if less inclined to think his victories quite so hollow. Lawrence had fought enough Frenchmen at sea to know they were no slouches in battle, if not much in the way of sailors. Still, he did not think they were soldiers of the Prussian calibre, and it was heartening to be among a company of men so determined on victory. Nothing like shyness known among them, or even uncertainty. They were worthy allies. He knew without question he should not hesitate to range himself in line with them on the day of battle and trust his own life to their courage. As near the highest encomium he could give, and which made all the more unpleasant his sensations, when Dyhern drew him aside as they left the mess together one evening.
"I hope you will allow me to speak without offence," Dyhern said. "Never would I instruct a man how his dragon is to be managed. But you have been out in the East so long. Now he has some strange ideas in his head, I think."
Diherne was a plain-spoken soldier, but he did not speak unkindly, and his words were intended in the nature of a gentle hint. Mortifying enough to receive, for all that, with his suggestion that perhaps he has not been exercised enough, or he has been kept from battle too often. It is good not to let them grow preoccupied. His own dragon, Eroica, was certainly an exemplar of Prussian dragon discipline. He even looked the role, with the heavy overlapping plates of bone which ringed his neck and travelled up the ridges of his shoulders and wings, giving him an armoured appearance. Despite his vast size, he showed no inclination to indolence, instead being rather quick to chide the other dragons if they should flag, and was always ready to answer a call to drill. The other Prussian dragons were much in awe of him, and willingly stood aside to let him take first fruits when they had their meals. Lawrence had been invited to let Temeraire feed from the pen once they had committed to joining the battle, and Temeraire, inclined to be jealous of his own precedence, would not hang back in Eroica's favour. Nor would Lawrence have liked to see him do so, for that matter. If the Prussians did not choose to make more use of Temeraire's gifts, that was their lookout. He could even appreciate the reasoning that kept them from disrupting their beautifully precise formations by introducing at so late a date a new participant. But he would not have stood for a moment any disparagement of Temeraire's qualities, nor tolerated a suggestion Temeraire was in any way not the equal, and to his own mind the superior, of Eroica. Eroica did not object to sharing his dinner himself, but the other Prussian dragons looked a little sourly at Temeraire's daring, and they all of them stared when Temeraire did not immediately eat, but took his kill over to Gongsu to be cooked first.
"It always tastes just the same if you only eat it plain," Temeraire said to their very dubious expressions. "It is much nicer to have it cooked. Try a little, and you will see."
Eroica made no answer to this but a snort, and deliberately tore into his own cows quite raw, devouring them down to the hooves. The other Prussian dragons at once followed his example.
"It is better not to give in to their whims," Diherne added to Lawrence now. "It seems a small thing, I know. Why not let them have all the pleasure they can when they are not fighting? But it is just as with men. There must be discipline, order, and they are the happier for it."
Guessing that Temeraire had once again broached the subject of his reforms with the Prussian dragons, Lawrence answered him a little shortly, and went back to Temeraire's clearing to find him curled up unhappily and silent. What little inclination Lawrence had to reproach him vanished in the face of his disappointed droop, and Lawrence went to him at once to stroke his soft muzzle.
"They say I am soft for wishing to eat cooked food and for reading," Temeraire said low, "and they think I am silly for saying dragons ought not to have to fight. They none of them wanted to listen."
"Well," Lawrence said gently, "my dear, if you wish dragons to be free to choose their own way, you must be prepared that some of them will wish to make no alteration. It is what they are used to, after all."
"Yes, but surely anyone can see that it is nicer to be able to choose," Temeraire said. "It is not as though I do not want to fight, whatever that booby Eroica says," he added, with abrupt and mounting indignation, his head coming up off the ground and the ruff spreading. "And what he has to say to anything when he does not think of anything but counting the number of wing-beats between one turn and the next, I should like to know. At least I am not stupid enough to practice 10 times a day just how best to show my belly to anyone who likes to come at me from the flank."
Lawrence received this stroke of temper with dismay, and tried to apply himself to soothing Temeraire's jangled nerves, but to little success.
"He said that I ought to practice my formations instead of complaining," Temeraire continued heatedly, "when I could roll them up in 2 passes the way they fly. He ought to stay at home and eat cows all day long for the good they will do in a battle."
At last he allowed himself to be calmed, and Lawrence thought nothing more of it. But in the morning, sitting and reading with Temeraire, now puzzling laboriously for his benefit, through a famous novel by the writer Goethe, a piece of somewhat dubious morality called Die Leiden des Jungen Werther, Lawrence saw the formations go up for their battle drills, and Temeraire, still smarting, took the opportunity to make a great many critical remarks upon their form, which seemed to Lawrence accurate so far as he could follow them. "Do you suppose he is only in a savage mood, or mistaken?" Lawrence privately asked Granby afterwards. "Surely such flaws cannot have escaped them all this time."
"Well, I don't say I have a perfectly clear picture of what he is talking about," Granby said, "but he isn't wrong in any of it so far as I can tell. and you recall how handy he was at thinking up those new formations back during our training. It's a pity we've never yet had a chance of putting them to work."
"I hope I do not seem to be critical," Lawrence said to Dyhern that evening, "but though his ideas are at times unusual, Temeraire is remarkably clever at such things, and I would consider myself amiss not to raise the question to you."
Dyhern eyed Lawrence's makeshift and hasty diagrams, and then shook his head, smiling faintly.
"No, no, I take no offence. How could I, when you so politely bore my own interference?" he said. "Your point is well taken. What's right for one is not always fair for the other. Strange how very different the tempers of dragons can be. He would be unhappy and resentful if you were always correcting or denying him, I expect."
"Oh, no," Lawrence said, dismayed. "Dyhern, I meant to make no such implication. I beg you believe me quite sincere in wishing to draw to your attention a possible weakness in our defence, and nothing more."
Dyhern did not seem convinced, but he did look over the diagrams a little longer, and then stood up and clapped Lawrence on the shoulder.
"Come, do not worry," he said. "Of course there are some openings you here have found. There is no manoeuvre without its points of weakness. But it is not so easy to exploit a little weakness in the air as it might seem upon paper. Frederick the Great himself approved these drills. With them we beat the French at Rosbach. We will beat them again here."
With this reply, Lawrence had to be content, but he went away dissatisfied. A dragon properly trained ought to be a better judge of aerial manoeuvres than any man, it seemed to him, and Dyhern's answer more wilful blindness than sound military judgment.
Chapter 12. The inner councils of the army were wholly opaque to Lawrence. The barrier of language and their establishment in the covert, far from most other divisions of the army, distanced him twice over, even from the usual rumours that went floating through the camp. What little he heard was contradictory and vague. They would be concentrating at Erfurt. They would be concentrating at Hof. They would catch the French at the River Saale, or at the Main. And meanwhile the weather was turning to autumnal chill and the leaves to yellow around their edges without any movement. Nearly 2 weeks had crept by in camp, and then at last the word came. Prince Louis summoned the captains to a nearby farmhouse for dinner, fed them handsomely out of his own purse, and to their even greater satisfaction enlightened them a little.
"We mean to make a push south through the Thuringian forest passes," he said. "General Hohenlohe will advance through Hof towards Bamberg, while General Brunswick and the main army go through Erfurt towards Würzburg," he went on, pointing out the locations on a great map spread out over the dinner table, the destination towns near the known positions where the French army had been established over the summer. "We have still not heard that Bonaparte has left Paris. If they choose to sit in their cantonments and wait for us, all the better. We will strike them before they know what has happened."
Their own destination, as part of the advance guard, would be the town of Hof, on the borders of the Great Forest. The march would not be quick, so many men were not easily supplied, and there were some 70 miles to cover. Meanwhile, along their route, supply depots had to be established, particularly with herds for the dragons, and the lines of communication secured. But with all these caveats, still Lawrence went back to the clearing with much satisfaction. At last, to know something and to be moving was 1,000 times better, no matter how slow it would seem to abruptly be bounded by the speed of infantry and cavalry dragging their guns along in wagons.
"But why do we not go farther out ahead?" Temeraire said, when an easy 2 hours' flight had brought them the next morning to their new covert. "It is not as though we are doing anything of use here but making ourselves some clearings. Even those slow dragons can manage flying a little longer, surely."
"They don't want us getting too far off from the infantry," Granby said, "for our sake as much as theirs. If we went off on our own and ran into a troop of French dragons with a regiment of their own infantry and a couple of guns to back them up, we shouldn't enjoy it above half."
In such a case, the enemy dragons would have a clear advantage, the field guns giving them a space of safety in which to regroup and rest, and providing a zone of danger against which the dragons without infantry support could be pinned. But despite this explanation, Temeraire still sighed, and only grumblingly reconciled himself to knocking down some more trees, for firewood, and to clear space for himself and the Prussian dragons, while they waited for the marching infantry to catch up. In this creeping manner they had covered barely 25 miles in 2 days,
when abruptly their orders were changed.
"We will be massing first at Jena,"
Prince Louis said, shrugging ruefully at the vagaries of the senior officers who continued to meet daily, ferried back and forth by dragon couriers.
"General Brunswick wishes to move all the army together through Erfurt instead."
"First we move not at all, and now we change directions," Lawrence said to Granby with some irritation. They had already gone farther south than Jena, and now would have to travel some distance northward as well as west. With the slow pace of the infantry, it might mean half a day lost. They would do better to have fewer of these conferences, and to more point.
The army was not assembled around Jena until early October. By then, Temeraire was hardly the only one irritated with the pace. Even the most stolid of the Prussian dragons were restless at being held on so short a rein, and strained their necks out westward daily, as if they might win a few more miles by wishing for them. The town was upon the banks of the great Saale River, broad and unfordable, which would serve well as a barrier to defend. Their original destination of Hof lay only 20 miles farther south along its course, and Lawrence, studying the maps laid out in the impromptu captain's mess, organized in a large pavilion, shook his head. The change of position seemed to him a retreat without cause.
"No, you see, some of the cavalry and infantry have been sent ahead to Hof anyway," Dyhern said. "A little bit of bait to make them think we are coming that way, and then we pour down on them through Erfurt and Würzburg, and catch them still in parts."
It sounded well enough, but there was a small obstacle to the plan shortly discovered. The French were already in Würzburg. The news travelled round the camp like wildfire, scarcely moments after the panting courier had ducked into the commander's tent, reaching even the aviators with scarcely any delay.
"They say Napoleon himself is there," one of the other captains said. "The Imperial Guard is at Mainz, and his marshals are all over Bavaria. The whole Grande Armée is mobilized."
"Well, and so much the better," Dyhern opined. "At least no more of this damned marching, thank God. Let them come to us for their thrashing."
Into this sentiment they were all prepared to enter, and a sudden energy gripped the camp. All sensed that battle was close at hand, as the senior officers again closeted themselves for intense discussions. There was no shortage of news and rumours now. Every hour, it seemed, some fresh piece of intelligence reached them, though still the Prussians were sending out scarcely any reconnaissance missions for fear of their capture.
"You will enjoy this, gentlemen," Prince Louis said, coming into their mess. "Napoleon has made a dragon an officer. It has been seen giving orders to the captains of his aerial corps."
"Its captain, surely," one of the Prussian officers protested.
"No, it has none at all, nor any kind of crew," Prince Louis said, laughing.
Lawrence, however, found nothing amusing in the news, particularly when confirmed in his suspicion that the dragon in question was entirely white.
"We will see to it you have a chance at her on the field, never fear," Dyhern said only, when Lawrence had briefly acquainted them all with Lien and her history.
"Ha-ha! Maybe the French will not have been practicing their formations if she is in charge. Making a dragon an officer, next he will promote his horse to general."
"It does not seem at all silly to me," Temeraire said with a sniff, when this had been passed along.
He was disgruntled at the news of Lien's preferment among the French when contrasted with his own treatment by the Prussians.
"But she can't know a thing about battles, Temeraire, not like you," Granby said. "Yong Xing kicked up such a fuss about Celestials not fighting. She shan't ever have been in one herself." "My mother said that Lien was a very great scholar," Temeraire said, "and there are many Chinese books about aerial tactics. There is one by the Yellow Emperor himself, though I did not have a chance to read it," he finished regretfully.
"Oh, things out of books," Granby said, waving a hand.
Lawrence said grimly, "Bonaparte is no fool. I am sure he has their strategy well in his own hands, and if giving Lien rank were enough excuse to convince her to come into the battle, I am sure he would make her a Marshal of France and call it cheap at the price. It is the divine wind we must fear now, and what it may do to the Prussian forces, not her generalship."
"If she tries to hurt our friends, I will stop her," Temeraire said, adding under his breath, "but I am sure she is not wasting time on silly formations."
They moved out of Jena early the next morning, with Prince Louis and the rest of the advance guard, for the town of Saalfeld, a cautious 10 miles south of the rest of the army, to await the French advance. All was quiet on their arrival. Lawrence took a moment to go into the town before the infantry should come in, hoping through the offices of Lieutenant Badenhauer, one of the young Prussian officers added to his crew, to acquire some decent wine and better provender. Having replenished his funds in Dresden, he now meant to give his senior officers a dinner that night, and arrange for some special provision for the rest of his crew. The first battle could come now at any day, and both supplies and the time to prepare them would likely grow short during the ensuing manoeuvres. The Saale River trotted briskly astride their course, energetic though the autumn rains had not yet begun. Lawrence paused halfway across the bridge and thrust a long branch into the water, down to the limit of his arm, not yet at the bottom, and then as he knelt lower to try and reach a little farther, a surge of the current pulled it roughly from his hand.
"I would not like to try and ford that, and least of all with artillery," Lawrence said, wiping his hands as he came off the bridge.
Though Badenhauer barely knew any English, he nodded in full agreement. Translation was scarcely necessary. The inhabitants were not well pleased with the coming invasion of their sleepy little town, but the shopkeepers were ready enough to be mollified with gold, even if the women closed the shutters on the upper stories of their houses with some vehemence as they walked past. They made their arrangements with the keeper of a small inn, who was despondently willing to sell many of his provisions, before the main body of troops should arrive and likely commandeer the rest. He lent them also a couple of his young sons to carry the supplies back.
"Pray tell them there is nothing to fear,"
Lawrence told Badenhauer as they crossed back over the river and drew near the covert, the excited dragons making an unusually loud noise, chattering with one another. The boys' eyes had grown saucer wide in their faces. They were not much comforted by whatever Badenhauer said and ran off home almost before Lawrence managed to give them each a few pennies in thanks. As they left the food, however, delicious smells rising from the baskets, nobody much minded. Gong Su took charge of the meals. He had by now mostly acquired the role of cook for the men as well as Temeraire. That duty ordinarily rotated about the men of the ground crew and rarely well performed. They had all gradually grown used to the creeping inclusion of Oriental spices and preparations in their food, until now they would most likely have noticed their absence more. The cook was left otherwise unoccupied. Eroica said to Temeraire, as the dragons assembled for their own repast,
"Come and eat with us. Fresh meat is what you need on the eve of a battle. Hot blood puts fire into the breast,"
encouragingly, and Temeraire, who could not conceal he was pleased to be so invited, assented, and indeed tore into his cow with great eagerness, if he did lick his chops clean with more fastidiousness than the rest, and wash himself in the river after. There was nearly a holiday atmosphere by the time the first of the cavalry squadrons began to come across the river, and the sounds and smells of horses reached them through the curtain of trees, the creak and the sharp smell of oil from the gun carriages. The rest of the men would not arrive until morning. As dusk came on, Lawrence took Temeraire for a short, solitary flight to let him dissipate some of the nervous energy which had set him to clawing the ground again. They went high up, so as not to alarm the horses, and Temeraire hovered a while squinting through the twilight.
"Lawrence, will we not be left very open on this ground?" Temeraire asked, craning his head around. "We cannot get back across the river very quickly if there is only that one bridge, and there are all those woods about."
"We do not mean to cross back over. We are holding the bridge for the rest of the army," Lawrence explained. "If they came up and the French were in possession of this bank, it would be very difficult to cross over in the face of their resistance, so we must hold it if ever we can."
"But I do not see any more of the army coming," Temeraire said. "What I mean is, I can see Prince Louis and the rest of the advance guard, but no one else behind us, and there are a great many campfires over there in front."
"That damned infantry is creeping along again, I dare say," Lawrence said, squinting northward himself. He could just make out the lights of Prince Louis's carriage, swaying along the road towards the encampment around the town, and beyond that, nothing but darkness, far into the distance, while in the south small smoky campfires were winking in and out of view like fireflies, brilliant in the thickening dark. The French were less than a mile away. Prince Louis was not backwards in his response. By dawn his battalions were moving rapidly over the bridge and taking up their positions. Some 8,000 men with more than 44 guns to support them, though half of them were the conscripted Saxons, whose mutterings were all the louder now that the French were known to be so near. The first musket shots began to ring out only a little later. Not the real beginning of a battle, only the advance outposts trading a little desultory fire with the French scouts. By 9 in the morning,
The French were coming out of the hills, keeping well back in the trees where the dragons could not easily get at them. Eroica led his formation in threatening great sweeps over their heads, with Temeraire following after them, but with little effect. Temeraire had been forbidden to use the divine wind so near to the cavalry. To their general frustration, they were shortly signalled back so that the cavalry and infantry might make their way forward and engage. Eroica threw out a signal flag.
"Down! Land!"
Badenhaar, sitting close at Lawrence's left, translated, and they all dropped down into the covert again. A panting runner was there with fresh orders for Captain Dyhern.
"Well, my friends, we are in luck!" Dyhern called back to all the formation cheerfully, waving the packet overhead. "That is Marshal Lannes over there, and there is a pile of eagles to be run today. The cavalry will have their turn for a while. We are to try and come around behind them and see if we can scare up a few French dragons to fight with."
They went up again, high over the battlefield. With the pressure of the dragon formation lifted, the French skirmishers had burst out of the woods to engage the front ranks of Prince Louis's forces, and behind them marched out a single battalion of infantry in line and some squadrons of light cavalry. Not yet a great commitment of forces, but the battle was properly joined, and now the guns began to speak in their deep, thundering voices. Shadows were moving through the wooded hills, impossible to make out their exact movements, and as Lawrence turned his glass upon them, Temeraire let out a ringing roar. A French formation of dragons had lifted into the air and was coming for them. The formation was considerably larger than Eroica's, but made almost wholly of smaller dragons, most of them lightweights, and even a few courier types among them. They had none of the crispness that marked the Prussian manoeuvres. They had formed into a sort of pyramid, but a shaky one, and were beating up at such different speeds that they were changing places with one another as they came. Eroica and his formation came about in perfect order to meet the onrushing French, spreading out into a doubled line at two heights. Temeraire was nearly turning himself in circles, trying not to overshoot their left flank, where Lawrence had set him to take up position, but the Prussians were in formation before the French reached them, and riflemen aboard each dragon levelled their guns for the devastating volley fire for which the Prussians were justly feared. But just as they came into rifle range, and the guns began to crack, the French formation dissolved into even more complete chaos, dragons darting in every direction, and the Prussian volley made almost no impression. A very neat piece of work, tempting the volley out of them, Lawrence was forced to acknowledge. But he did not at once see the point. It would not do them much good when the little French dragons did not carry the manpower to return fire in kind. They did not seem to wish to, either. Instead, they only circled around in a frantic, buzzing cloud, keeping a safe distance too far for boarding, and their crews firing off shots almost at random, picking off men here and there, dashing in for a moment to claw or snap at the Prussian dragons in any opening they were given. Of those there were many. Temeraire's peevish criticisms were proving all too accurate, and nearly every dragon of the Prussian force was soon marked and bleeding here and there, as bewildered they tried to go about in one direction or another to face their opponents properly. Temeraire, moving alone, was able best to avoid the skirmishing smaller dragons and pay them back. With no threat of boarding and gunnery and their waste of ammunition against such small, quick targets, Lawrence only gave him his head, and waved his men to stay low and keep out of the way. Pursuing fiercely, Temeraire caught one after another of the littler French dragons, giving them each a vigorous shake and clawing that had them squalling in pain and retreating hastily from the field. But he was only one, and there were a great many more of the small dragons than he alone could catch. Lawrence would have liked to try and tell Dyhern to break up the formation and let the single dragons fight as they would. At least they would not have been rendering themselves so predictably vulnerable, over and over, and their heavier weight ought to have told badly against the smaller dragons. He had no opportunity, but after a few more passes, Dyhern reached the same conclusion. Another signal flag went up, and the formation broke apart. The blooded, pain-maddened dragons threw themselves with renewed energy at the French.
"No, no!"
Temeraire cried, startling Lawrence, and whipping his head around said, "Lawrence, down there, look!" He leaned over the side of Temeraire's neck, already pulling out his glass. A great body of French infantry were coming out of the woods to the west, enveloping Prince Louis's right flank, and the centre was being pressed back by hard, determined fighting. Men were falling back over the bridge, and the cavalry had no room to charge. Just now would have been the ideal moment for a dragon sweep to drive back the flanking attempt, but with the formation broken up it was almost sure to fail.
"Temeraire, go!"
Lawrence cried, and already drawing in his breath, Temeraire folded his wings and arrowed downwards, towards the encroaching French troops on the west. His sides swelled out, and Lawrence pressed his hands over his ears to muffle a little of that terrible roaring force as Temeraire unleashed the divine wind. His pass complete, he swept up and away. Dozens of men lay crumpled and still upon the ground, blood oozing from their nostrils and their ears and their eyes, and the smaller trees lying cast around them like matchsticks. The Prussian defenders were a little more dazed themselves than heartened, however, and in their shocked pause a Frenchman in an officer's uniform leapt from the trees and out amongst his own dead, holding up a standard and shouting, "Vive l'Empereur! Vive la France!" He charged forward, and behind him came all the rest of the French advance guard, nearly 2,000 men, and poured down against the Prussians, hacking away with their bayonets and sabres, getting in amongst them so Temeraire could not strike again without killing as many of their own side. The case was growing desperate. Everywhere the infantrymen were being forced into the Saale River and dragged down by the current and the weight of their own boots, the horses' hooves slipping on the banks. With Temeraire hovering, searching for an opening, Lawrence saw Prince Louis rally the rest of the cavalry for a charge at the centre. The horses massed around him, and with a roar and thunder they threw themselves gallantly forward to meet the French hussars with an impact like a ringing bell, swords against sabres. The clash stirred up the thick black clouds of gunpowder smoke around them, to cling to the horses' legs and go whirling about them like a storm. Lawrence hoped for a moment, and then he saw Prince Louis fall, the sword spilling from his hand, and a terrible cheer rose from the French as the Prussian colours went down beside him. No rescue came. The Saxon battalions broke first and spilled wildly across the bridge, or flung down their arms in surrender. The Prussians held in small pockets as Prince Louis's subordinates tried to hold the men together and withdraw in good order. Most of the guns were being abandoned upon the field, and the French were raking the Prussians with a deadly fire, men toppling to the ground or falling into the river in droves as they tried to flee. Others began to retreat northward along the line of the river. The bridge fell scarcely after noon. By then, Temeraire and the other dragons were only engaged in defending the retreat, trying to keep the small, darting French dragons from turning the withdrawal into a complete rout. They did not meet with much success. The Saxons were in full flight, and the smaller French dragons were snatching up artillery and horses alike away from the Prussian forces, some with screaming men still aboard, and depositing them back into the hands of the French infantry, now establishing themselves upon the far bank of the Saale, amidst the still shuttered buildings of the town. The fighting was all but over. The signal flags, Sauve qui peut, fluttered sadly from the ruin of the Prussian position, and the clouds of smoke were drifting away. The French dragons fell back at last, as the retreat drew too far away from their infantry support, and all drooping and weary, Temeraire and the Prussian dragons came to earth to catch their breath at Dyhern's signal. He did not attempt to cheer them. There was no cheer to be had. The littlest dragon of the formation, a lightweight, was carrying carefully in his talons the broken body of Prince Louis, recovered in a desperate lunge from the battlefield. Dyhern only said briefly, "Collect your grand crews and fall back on Jena. We will rendezvous there." Chapter 13 Lawrence had put down his ground crew deep in the countryside on the far bank of the Saale, tucked into a well-hidden, forested defile, not easily seen from above. They were standing all together, the strongest of the hands in front, with axes and sabres and pistols held ready, and canes and runners to the back, the eggs tucked safely in their swaddling and harness near a small, screened-off fire.
"We heard the guns going near since you left us, sir," Fellows said anxiously, even as he and his men began looking over Temeraire's harness for damage.
"Yes," Lawrence said. "They overran our position. We are falling back on Jena."
He felt as though he were speaking from a great distance. An immense weariness had hold of him which could not be allowed to show.
"A ration of rum for all the flight crew. See to it, if you please, Mr. Rowland, Mr. Dyer," he said, letting himself down.
Emily and Dyer carried the spirit bottles around with a glass, and the men each drank their tot. Lawrence took his own last, with gratitude. The hot liquor was at least an immediate presence. He went back to speak with Keynes over the eggs.
No harm at all, the surgeon said. They could keep like this a month without difficulties.
Have you any better sense of when we may expect the hatching? Lawrence asked.
Nothing whatsoever has changed, Keynes said in his peevish way. We still have anywhere from 3 weeks to five, or I should have said.
Very good, Lawrence said, and sent him to look over Tamerere, in case there should be any sign of injury to his muscles, a result of overextending himself, which in the heat of battle or the present sorrow he might not have noticed.
It was mostly that they took us by surprise, Tamerere said miserably, as Keynes clambered over him. And those wretched formations! Oh, Lawrence, I ought to have said more and made them listen!
There was scarcely any hope of your doing so under the circumstances, Lawrence said. Do not reproach yourself. Think rather how the formation movements might most easily be amended, without causing them great confusion. I hope we may persuade them to heed your advice now, and if so, we will have repaired a grave fault in tactics, at no more cost than the loss of one skirmish. As painful a lesson as it has been, we will then count ourselves fortunate it was no worse.
They arrived at Jena in the small hours of the morning. The army was drawing up close around the town, withdrawing in upon itself. The French had captured a badly needed supply train at Gera, and the depots in the town were near empty. There was only a single small sheep for Tamerere to eat. Gong Su stretched it by stewing, with the addition of some aromatics which he had gathered, and Tamerere made a better meal than the men, who had to make do with a sort of hastily cooked porridge and hard-baked bread. There was an ugly murmuring all through the camp as Lawrence walked by the fires. Saxon stragglers coming in from the battlefield were murmuring that they had borne the brunt of the attack, sacrificed to try and hold the French. And worse yet, there had been another defeat. General Tauentzien, retreating from Hof in the face of the French advance, had backed out of Marshal Soult's arms and straight into Marshal Bernadotte's, from frying pan to fire, and had lost 400 men before at last escaping. Enough to disquiet any man, much less those who had been counting on an easy, assured victory. There was little sign of that early, supreme confidence any more. He found Dyhern and the other Prussian aviators having claimed a small, ramshackle cottage, hastily deserted by its peasant tenants when the dragons descended upon their fields, for their meagre comfort.
"I'm not proposing any wholesale alteration," Lawrence said urgently, laying out his diagrams, sketched to Tamerere's orders. "Only what changes can easily be accommodated. Whatever risks are entailed in so desperate a change in the final hour can scarcely be measured against the certainty of disaster if nothing be done."
"You are kind enough not to say, 'I told you so,' Dyhern said. "But I hear it, none the less. Very well, we will let a dragon be our instructor and see what can be done. At least we will not be sitting in covert, licking our wounds like dogs after a beating."
He and his fellow captains had been sitting gloomily around the mostly bare table, drinking in silence. Now he rallied himself and them both with an immense effort, and by sheer force of personality put fresh heart into them, chiding them for getting into the dumps, and very nearly dragged them bodily outside and back to their dragons. The activity perked up their heads and spirits, Tamerere not least of all. He sat up bright-eyed as they all assembled, and gladly threw himself into the exercise, showing them the new flying patterns which he had devised. To these Lawrence and Granby had contributed little, but simplified much. Elaborate manoeuvres which Tamerere could perform without a thought were simply beyond the physical agility of most Western dragon breeds. Even considerably slowed down, the new patterns gave the Prussians, so long inculcated with their formal drills, some difficulty at first, but the precision which informed their regular practice slowly began to tell, and after a dozen passes or so they were tired but triumphant. Some of the other dragons with the army had crept up to observe, and shortly after their officers came too. When Dyhern and his formation dropped down at last for a rest, they were quickly mobbed with questions, and shortly a couple of other formations were in the air trying their own hand. Their practice was interrupted that afternoon, however, by a fresh change of plans. The army was concentrating anew about Weimar, with intentions of falling back to protect their lines of communications with Berlin, and once again the dragons would lead the way. An angry grumbling met this news. Before now, all the marching hither and yon, the changing orders, had been taken in good spirits, viewed as the inevitable shifting course of a war. But to fall back again now pell-mell, as if a couple of small French victories were enough to chase them home, was infuriating to all, and the confusion of orders took on the more unsettling cast of a lack of decision among the commanders.
In this hostile mood, the further news reached them that the ill-fated Prince Louis had taken his position across the Saale in answer to unclear orders by Hohenlohe, which had indeed implied an advance in progress, though this same advance had not been properly authorized by Brunswick or the king. The whole army had never stirred southward in the end, Hohenlohe evidently thinking better of his plans. "He sent fresh orders to fall back," Dyhern said bitterly, having heard the news from one of Prince Louis's aides-de-camp, who had just struggled back to camp on foot, his poor horse having foundered crossing the Saale. "But we were already engaged by then, and our prince had not an hour left of life, so has Prussia thrown away one of her finest soldiers." They could not be said to be mutinous, but they were very angry all, and worse than that, discouraged. The sense of achievement built over the afternoon worn away. They went silently to their several clearings to oversee the work of packing. The sound of the courier dragon leaving the covert had begun to be a hateful noise, signifying yet another of the endless futile conferences was underway. Lawrence woke to that flurry of wings in the still black hours of the morning, and rolled out of his tent in bare feet and shirt-sleeves to scrub his face at the water-barrel. No frost yet, but more than cold enough to wake a man properly. Temeraire lay sleeping still, breath coming in warm puffs from his nostrils. Salyer looked up alertly when Lawrence glanced into the cramped, half-sized tent where he and the snoring Alan had kept the night's watch over the eggs. The warmest place in camp, the fabric doubled over and the brazier coals glowing. They were in covert now a little ways north of Jena, near the eastern edge of the Prussian army, almost united. The Duke of Brunswick had moved his own forces closer during the night. The whole countryside seemed alive with campfires, whose smoke mingled sadly with the burning town in the distance. Something between a panic and a riot had broken out among Hohenlohe's forces the previous night over too little food and too much bad news. The French advance guard had been sighted again just to the south, and several anticipated supply trains had not arrived. Too much, particularly for the Saxons, reluctant allies to begin with and now thoroughly disenchanted. Separated from the rest of the camp as the covert was, Lawrence had not seen much of the unhappy events, but before calm could be restored, fires had caught among the buildings, and now the morning air was acrid and bitter with the floating ash and smoke, damp with dense fog. It was early on the 13th of October, almost a month now since their arrival in Prussia, and still he had received no word from England, the post slow and uncertain, with the countryside full of armed men. Standing alone with his tea at the edge of the clearing, he looked northwards, yearning. He deeply felt the want of connection, so tantalizingly close, and he had rarely known so great a desire to be at home, even when 1,000 miles more distant. The sun was beginning to make some forays towards dawn, but the fog held on grimly, a thick grey mist blanketing all the encampment. Sounds travelled only a short way, deadened queerly, or came seemingly out of nowhere, so one saw ghostly, silent figures moving without sound, and in another direction heard disembodied voices floating. The men rose sluggishly and went about their work without speaking much one to the other, tired and hungry. The orders came shortly after 10 in the morning. The main body of the army would retreat northwards through Auerstadt, while Hohenlohe's forces kept their position, covering the retreat. Lawrence read it silently and handed it back to Dyhern's runner without comment. He would not speak critically of the Prussian command to a Prussian officer. The Prussians were less reticent amongst themselves, loud in their own tongue as the instructions went around.
"They say we ought to give the French a proper battle here, and I think they are quite right," Temeraire said. "Why are we here at all, if not to fight? We might have stayed at Dresden for all this marching we have been doing. It is as though we are running away."
"It is not our place to say such things," Lawrence said. "There may be intelligence which we lack that makes sense of all these manoeuvres."
This was a small sop to comfort. He did not very much believe it himself. They were not themselves to move at any time soon, and as the dragons had been fed but poorly 3 days running now, orders were given not to ask them for any exertions, since at any moment they might be called on for a fresh march or a battle, though that at least seemed now less likely. Temeraire settled to drowse and dream of sheep, and Lawrence said to Granby,
"John, I'm going to go and have a look around from higher ground outside this blasted fog,"
leaving him in command.
A flat-topped height, the Landgrafenberg, commanded the plateau and valley of Jena. Lawrence took young Badenhauer as his guide again, and together they pushed their way up through a narrow, winding ravine that led up its wooded slopes, choked in places by wicked-thorned blackberry bushes. Farther up, the track faded out into the tall grasses. No one had mowed the hay here, the hill too steep to bother, though here and there the taller trees had been cut, and level clearings trampled flat by sheep. A couple of them looked up incuriously and trotted off into the bracken. Sweating, they gained the summit after almost an hour of toil. "So," Badenhauer said, waving his hand inarticulately at the fine prospect. Lawrence nodded. A ring of smoke-blue mountains closed off the view in the far distance, but from their ideal vantage point all the bowl of the valley was spread in a circle around them almost like a living map, its gentler hills furred by yellowing beeches and smaller stands of evergreens, a few white-skinned birches stark among them. The fields were mostly brown-yellow and flat, much of the harvest taken in, muted in the thin autumnal light that made the day seem already far advanced, and threw the scattered farmhouses into brilliant relief. A heavy bank of clouds moving steadily westward presently blocked off the morning sun from their immediate view, the shadow creeping up and over the hills. By contrast, a fragment of the Saale River, nestled among the hills farther away, caught the sunlight full on and blazed incandescent at them, until Lawrence found his eyes almost watering with the brilliance. The wind rose, a low, fire-crackling sound of crumpled leaves and dry branches, and under that the deeper, hollow roar, rather like a sail first belling out, but going on and on without an end. Otherwise there was an immense silence. The air tasted, smelled, strangely barren. No animal fragrance or rot. The ground already hard with frost. On the side of the mountain from which they had come, the Prussian army lay in its serried ranks, mostly obscured under the thick blanket of fog, but here and there the sunlight flickered valiantly on bayonets, as Brunswick's legions started to draw away north towards Auerstadt. Lawrence cautiously went to peer over the opposite side, where the town lay. There was no definite sign of the French, but the fires in Jena were going out. The orange, glowing remnants, like coals from this height, faded one by one amid indistinct voices, shouting. Lawrence could just dimly make out the forms of horses with carts going to and from the river carrying water. He stood a while, contemplating the ground, pantomiming to Badenhauer with occasional recourse to the handful of French they both possessed, and then they both went still at once. A breath of wind blew the thick, climbing pillar of smoke away from the town, and revealed a dragon coming into view from the east. It was Lien, flying over the river and the town in a quick, hummingbird progress, stopping to hover here and again. There was one startled moment where Lawrence had the illusion of her flying directly towards them, a moment only, and then he realized it was no illusion. Badenhauer pulled on his arm, and together they threw themselves flat to the ground and crawled underneath the blackberry bushes, the long thorns scratching and pulling. Some 20 feet in they found a refuge hollowed out from the ground and the bramble, the work of sheep. The branches kept rustling after they had settled themselves in the low depression, and after a moment a sheep came struggling and kicking to join them in the little hollow, leaving behind great tufts of its wool strung from the thorns, a welcome screen. It flung itself down, shivering, beside them, perhaps finding some comfort in human company in its turn. As the white dragon folded her great wings, and let herself down gracefully onto the summit. Lawrence tensed, waiting. If she had seen them, if she were hunting them, a stand of blackberry would hardly keep her off for long. But she looked away, interested rather in the prospect which they themselves had been examining. There was something different in her appearance. In China he had seen her wear elaborate ensembles of gold and rubies. In Istanbul she had been wholly bare of jewels. But now she wore a very different piece, something like a diadem set around the base of her ruff and hooked cleverly under the edges and the jaw, made of shining steel rather than gold, and secure in the centre one enormous diamond, nearly the size of a chicken's egg, which blazed insolently even in the thin morning light. A man in a French officer's uniform let himself down off her back and sprang to the ground. Lawrence was deeply surprised to see that she had tolerated a passenger, still less one so undistinguished,
The officer was bare-headed, dark hair short and thinning, in only a heavy leather coat flung over a chasseur's uniform, high black boots over breeches, with a serviceable sword slung at his waist.
"Here is a fine thing. All our hosts assembled to greet us," he said,
his French oddly accented, opening up a glass to survey over the Prussian army with particular attention to the ranks flowing away onto the road north.
"We've kept them waiting too long, but that will soon be attended to. Davout and Bernadotte will send those fellows back to us presently. I do not see the banner of the king, do you?"
"No, and we should not wait here to find it, with no outposts established.
You are too exposed,"
Lien said, in disapproving tones, looking only indifferently over the field. Her blood-red eyes were not very strong.
"Come now, surely I am safe in your company?"
The officer chided her, laughing, and his smile, which momentarily he turned flashing up to her, gave light to his whole face. Badenau was gripping Lawrence's arm almost with convulsive pressure.
"Bonaparte,"
the Prussian hissed, when Lawrence glanced at him. Shocked, Lawrence turned back around, leaning closer to the bramble for a better look. The man was not particularly stunted, as he had always imagined the Corsican to be from the depictions in the British newspapers, but rather compact than short. At present, animated with energy, his large grey eyes brilliant and his face a little flushed from the cold wind, he might even have been called handsome.
"There is no hurry," Bonaparte added. "We can give them another 3/4 of an hour, I think, and let them send another division on to the road. A little walking to and fro will put them in just the right frame of mind."
He spent most of this allotted time pacing back and forth along the ridge, gazing thoughtfully out at the plateau below, much of the raptor in his expression, while Lawrence and Badenau, trapped, were forced to endure an agony of apprehension on the behalf of their fellows. A shudder by his side made Lawrence look. Badenau's hand had crept towards his pistol, a look of terrible indecision crossing the lieutenant's face. Lawrence put his hand on Badenau's arm, restraining, and the young man dropped his eyes at once, pale and ashamed, and let his hand down. Lawrence silently gave his shoulder a rough shake for comfort. The temptation he could well understand. Impossible not to entertain the wildest thoughts when scarcely 10 yards distant stood the architect of all Europe's woes. If there had been any hope of making him prisoner, it should certainly have been their duty to attempt it, however likely to end in personal disaster. But no attack out of the brush could possibly have succeeded. Their first movement would alert Lien, and Lawrence from personal experience knew well how quickly a celestial could take action. Their only possible chance was indeed the pistol, an assassin's shot from their concealed position at his unsuspecting back. No. Their duty was plain. They would have to wait, concealing themselves, and then bear the intelligence back to camp as quickly as they could muster, that Napoleon was closing upon them the jaws of a trap. The biter might yet be bit, and an honourable victory won. But in this task every minute should count, and it was a thorough-going torture to be forced to lie quiet and still watching the Emperor at his meditations.
"The fog is blowing off,"
Lien said, her tail flicking uneasily. She was squinting narrowly down towards the positions of Hohenlohe's artillery, which had the mountain in their view.
"You should not be risking yourself like this. Let us go at once. Besides, you have had all the reports you need."
"Yes, yes, my nursemaid,"
Bonaparte said absently, looking again through his glass.
"But it is a different thing to see with one's own eyes. There are at least 5 errors in the elevations on my maps, even without surveying, and those are not 3-pounders, but 6 with that horse artillery on their left."
"An emperor cannot also be a scout," she said severely. "If you cannot trust your subordinates, you ought to replace them, not do their work."
"Behold me properly lectured," Bonaparte said with mock indignation. "Even Berthier does not speak to me like this."
"He ought to, when you are being foolish," she said. "Come, you do not want to provoke them into coming up here and trying to hold the summit," she added cajolingly.
"Ah, they have missed their chance for that," he said. "But very well, I will indulge you.
It is time we got about the business in any case."
He put away his glass finally and stepped into her waiting, cupped talons, as though he had been used to be handled by a dragon all his life. Badenauer was scrambling heedlessly through the bramble almost before she was away. Lawrence burst out into the clearing behind him and stopped to look over the prospect one last time, searching for the French army. The fog was turning thin and insubstantial, wisping away, and now he could see clearly around Jena the corps of Marshal Lannes, busy heaping up depots of ammunition and food, salvaging for their shelter wood and materials from the burnt-out husks of the buildings, putting up empty pens. But though Lawrence pulled out his glass and looked in every direction, he could see no sign of any other mass of French troops immediately visible, certainly not this side of the Saale River. Where Bonaparte meant to get his men from, to launch any sort of attack, he could not see.
"We may yet be able to seize these heights, before he can get his men established," Lawrence said absently, only half to Badenauer.
A battery of artillery from this position would offer a commanding advantage over the plateau. Small wonder Bonaparte meant to seize it. But he had been backwards, it seemed, in getting a foothold. And then the dragons began popping up over the distant woods like jack-in-the-boxes, not the lightweights they had encountered in battle at Saalfeld, but the middleweights who made up the bulk of any aerial force. Pecheurs and papillons coming at great speed and out of formation. They landed among the French troops, securing Jena, something very odd in their appearance. Looking closer through the glass, Lawrence realized that they were all of them almost covered over with men, not their own crews only, but whole companies of infantry, clinging on to silk, carrying harnesses of the same style which he had seen used in China for the ordinary transport of citizens, only far more crowded. Every man had his own gun and knapsack. The largest of the dragons bore 100 men or more, and their talons were not empty. They carried, labouring, also whole caissons of ammunition, enormous sacks of food, and, shockingly, nets full of live animals. These, being deposited into the pens and cut free, went wandering about in aimless days, knocking into the walls and falling over, as visibly drugged as the pigs Temeraire had carried over the mountains not so very long ago. Lawrence sinkingly recognised the damnable cleverness of the scheme. If the French dragons had carried their own rations with them in this manner, there could be any number of them brought along, and not the few dozen which were counted the sum total who could be sustained by an army on the march through hostile territory. In the course of 10 minutes, nearly 1,000 men had been assembled on the ground, and the dragons were already turning back for fresh loads. They were coming, Lawrence estimated, scarcely a distance of 5 miles. But 5 miles with no road, heavily forested and broken by the river. A corps of men would ordinarily have taken a few hours to come across it. Instead, in minutes, they were landing in their new positions. How Bonaparte had induced his men to consent to attach themselves to dragons and be carried through the air, Lawrence could scarcely imagine, and had no time to consider. Badenauer was inarticulately pulling him away. In the distance were rising the heavy weights of l'Armée de l'Air, the great chevaliers and chansons de guerre in all their massive and terrible splendour, on a course for the summit itself, and they were carrying not food nor ammunition, but field guns. Lawrence and Badenauer flung themselves down the hillside and away, both of them skidding and sliding in a cloud of pebbles on the steep trail, clouds of dust and dying leaves stinging their faces as the dragons landed atop the summit. Halfway down the slope, Lawrence stopped long enough to risk a final look back. The heavyweights were discharging battalions by twos and threes, the men running at once to drag the guns into place along the foremost ridge, and the dragon's belly rigging was being unhooked to deposit great heaps of round shot and canister shot beside them. There would be no challenging them for the summit, and no chance of retreat. The battle would take place as Napoleon had desired, in the shadow of the French guns.